Welcome to another round of Boardroom or Miro Board. Today we talk retrospectives with Agile coach Maria. Let's go. First question. You've spent 2 hours in a team retro, but the only input you've heard is Dave's. Boardroom or Miro Board?
Boardroom. In Miro, Dave can't hog the space because everyone can add thoughts anonymously, online at the same time.
Correct. Next. You need the team to act on feedback fast, so you turn all those retro notes into Jira tasks instantly.
Miro all the way. And I can assign those tasks to teammates.
You're nailing this. Now, you see hundreds of sticky notes from the retro. A real mess. But you organize them into 5 themes in just seconds.
Miro, I basically get back an entire hour when I use its AI tools for clustering.
And she's done it.
Join over 60 million people running actually enjoyable and actionable retros in Miro. Get your first 3 boards free at Miro.com. That's Miro.com.
You're listening to The Dead Prussian, a podcast about war and warfare.
Military technology is a fascinating topic, whether you are talking satellite-killing missiles, unmanned aerial vehicles, reactive armor on tanks, or, a favorite of mine, precision-guided artillery munitions. One of the military technologies that seems to be a standard for soldiers around the world is often overlooked, though. This technology is actually older than most of the headline-grabbing gadgets, but it's far more ubiquitous on the battlefield. It is, of course, small arms. And I don't mean the type sported by a T-Rex. I mean rifles, pistols, and the like. G'day, listeners, and welcome to another episode of the Dead Prussian podcast, your favourite podcast named after a Prussian theorist, kind of. My guest today is Dr. Matthew Ford, a lecturer in international relations at the University of Sussex. He has a PhD from the Department of War Studies at King's College London, an MA from the same department, and a BA Honours in Philosophy from the University of Reading. After completing his doctorate in 2008, he joined the UK Civil Service as a strategic analyst with the UK Ministry of Defence. Matthew has published in a number of journals, including The Journal of Strategic Studies, Small Wars and Insurgencies, War in History, Studies in Conflict and Terrorism, and a good favourite of the show, Parameters. A former West Point Fellow and winner of the Society for Military History's Russell F. Wheatley Graduate Award, Matthew has written extensively about military technical change, especially as it relates to the infantry and their experience of battle. Matthew is the founding editor of the British Journal for Military History, but most importantly to me, he's the author of Weapon of Choice by Hurst & Co. London and Oxford University Press. This book was released, well, this year, a couple of weeks ago. Jump on Twitter, you will see it. It is in one person's feed in particular. Matthew, thanks for coming on the show.
Hey, Mick, thank you very much for inviting me. It's great to be joining you. I know it's first thing in the morning for you, but I'm ready for a beer, so... However you want to crack on.
We will crack on, mainly because it's a heat wave here and my very, very sophisticated equipment that's already starting to shut down is keeping me nice and warm at the moment. Now, you've written about the development of small arms, focusing mainly on the innovation and technological advances. Can you tell me a little bit about how you got interested in defence studies and then, in particular, the weapon of the infantryman?
Yeah, I certainly can. I decided I wanted to do a PhD about 15, 20 years ago, and I was always interested in military-related stuff, and I'd spent the last, I don't know, five years working for a management consultancy, and I worked a lot on IT strategy and and how to actually implement technology into businesses. And I wanted to see whether I could take my interest in military-related stuff and work it back through into what I knew about the more practical end of these things in terms of consulting and businesses and all the rest of it. And so that was my starting place. And what I realized was that when you're a consultant, there was always... when you're working for a management consultancy, the challenge was to identify technologies that you were at two ends of the problem, really. There were engineers that had solutions, and there were users that had demands, they had problems. The question was, which one led in the discussions? Did the engineer go to the user and say, look, I've got this great bit of kit, this will solve your problems? Or did the user say, look, I've got this problem, and go to the engineer and say, you know, I've got this problem, would you help, you know, solve it for me? And that was my starting place on all of this in terms of, and I was just thinking it through in terms of the background I'd had from management consultancy. And I went to my potential supervisor and I said, look, you know, I want to explore this problem, but I need a viable technology to work from. And I sort of come up with the usual, right? Aircraft carriers, ballistic missiles, tanks, you know, anything that sounded a bit more interesting, you know.
Yeah.
And then I just finished reading a newspaper article on how crap the SA-80A1 was. And I, you know, on a punt, I said, small arms. And to my horror, my potential supervisor's eyes lit up. And that was it. I've been stuffed with small arms now for the last, since 2003. And, you know, inevitably, small arms... Well, it wasn't small arms per se that were complicated, but it was how we might think about reading small arms and how we might think about reading technology change and the processes associated with technology change that became that required quite a bit of time to work through. And really, it was about getting away from, it was about getting away from under-theorized approaches and actually starting to realize that binary relationship that I'd initially set up between the engineer and the user, that kind of relationship where, you know, engineers are designed, you know, we'll build a website and they will come. Well, no, actually people, you know, it's not just about building a website and hoping that people will come. You have to figure out how to engage the user in a way that encourages them to come and then engage with the website so that you give them appropriate feedback loops. And there's all sorts of other, obviously, if you're an e-commerce director, you have to do all sorts of clever things to try and persuade people to eventually click, and then clickbait turns into money and da da da, all this kind of stuff. You know, in military technology terms, there are a number of ways of theorizing those relationships. And it was really about trying to understand how they might apply in small arms circumstances. And in that respect, the approach I've adopted isn't one that necessarily you would have come across in some of the more mainstream literatures that you would have read on innovation and military innovation. So that's how I've got into it. Small arms, they're interesting because they're taboo, right? People do stupid things with them. You wish they wouldn't, but they do. And as a result, there's a lot of controversy associated with them. And that makes them interesting as well. And of course, there's a lot of people write about them, right? And the question then is, and of course, also the story is really rather, you know, well known. Everyone knows something, you know, why would you be bothered about small arms? But actually, when you take a look again and took a look really, you know, in a much closer way, and certainly when you start getting into archives and other bits and pieces, you realise that a lot of what people say is utter, can I swear? Am I allowed to swear, Mick? I dare not.
You can swear, yeah.
It's just bollocks, actually, to be honest. You know, the internet has done no good whatsoever for people who are, you know, it feeds all sorts of nonsense. I mean, whether it's associated with what people do when they die when they're shot, or the science of killing, or all sorts of other bits and pieces, you know, and certainly social media and the web doesn't, you know, lend itself to that, lend itself to being able to tell more informed or meaningful stories, stories that actually can only be properly understood. You have to go and do some research, you know, you really have to get your hands dirty, not with the weapons themselves. Maybe sometimes I've been very lucky in that respect, in that I've got to work with people like Richard Jones, who's the editor of Jones Infantry Weapons, who was the last custodian of the MOD Pattern Room, which is one of the oldest, the oldest collection of small arms, and a very prestigious collection of small arms now associated with the Royal Armouries in Leeds in the United Kingdom. But, you know, people like that keep you true to your sort. You know, they know these things. They have technical intelligence that, I mean, as in an intelligence officer would have, partly because he was in that kind of environment himself. But yeah, the kind of technical intelligence that you have to respect and take seriously. You know, these people like Richard don't go around telling everyone all this stuff. The result is people make up all sorts of crap on the internet. And when you look at most gun nut books, with all due respect to gun nuts, because you have to be a gun nut to write a book called Weapon of Choice, I think, you do have to go back and think about how to do this systematically, looking at archives, interviewing properly, doing taking proper research methodology and working your way systematically through the material in order to tell a more coherent and, in my case, it's become, a more overly theorized story. But, there are different people have different ways of approaching innovation and what floats their boat, really. So, but that's the background, if you like.
The other interesting thing was the fact that I'd say about 60% of our listeners out there will not understood that you swore when you said bollocks. But let me assure you, listeners, that is 100% considered a swear word when you're in the UK.
Sorry.
I guess we should start off discussing the development of small arms. I'm more interested to understand whether or not the process has been fast or whether it's been slow.
Well, in that respect, talking about small arms is a bit bizarre, isn't it? Because we know that they've been around for centuries. And in terms of their form, their weight, all sorts of variables, they could hardly be described as the obvious place to go to when trying to think about how innovation works. Because, the major innovations, when you read most books about technology change in the armed forces, in the military, you go crossbow, then you go to Chevalier and stirrup and lance, and then you might end up with some clever armor of some kind. Then you go to gunpowder, of course, and eventually you'll get into the 19th century. We'll hit breech-loading rifles. We'll go muskets, breech-loading rifles. We'll talk about particular types of bullet, and then we'll swiftly move to machine guns before machine guns, and then to your particular interest, we'll start talking about artillery and how artillery and machine guns have revolutionised the battlefields of the First World War. And the rifle suddenly drops out of the picture of anyone's interest when it comes to discussing military technical change. There might be a moment where it's sort of about 1890, 1860, 1870, 1880, we start talking about railways and the telegraph and all this kind of stuff. And then, we're off to tanks, aircraft, and of course the big one is nuclear weapons. All of that sounds remarkably compelling, doesn't it? When there's a sort of a logical progression of lethality, if you like, from things that aren't very lethal or very effective, all the way to a piece of kit that is, annihilatory globally and, produces a global annihilation in the form of the bomb. And I suppose one of the targets, and it's an easy target once you start getting into it, one of the targets of my research is really to sort of start to pick apart this what I would describe as Whiggish or technologically deterministic mode of thinking about technology changes. If you go from lesser forms of technology to ideal forms of technology. In order to sort of try and show why those stories don't make sense, a rifle is as good a military technology as anything. Because what it shows, you can use the rifle for is exploring where the resistance to technological change is. Rather than, and I suppose the in many respects, whereas a lot of people are interested in how technology change can be promoted, how innovation can be promoted, a lot of what I'm interested in is what are the things that hold it back and why. I'm very much interested in the gutter politics, if you like, of technology change, because it's in those counter narratives about what hasn't worked and why, and what bits of kit could have come off but got sunk as a result of some kind of counter story by a different team that didn't particularly like this piece of kit, how those narratives emerge and how they play out in a number of different contexts, and show that things that you take for granted about military professions being, firstly, of course, there's the trope that the military are conservative and incapable of change and all the rest of it. And I've never considered that to be necessarily the case. I mean, clearly there are moments where, like any institution, it will protect its particular practices and work in particular ways. But when you trace the stories about individual, I mean, the point about taking a gun is it's very simple. A rifle is very simple. You can trace the discussions across the organisation because, you know, it's not very sophisticated. There are only 120 components maybe in a rifle. And so bearing that in mind, you can trace the stories about these things across the organisation, and you can see who in the organisation, and we're not just talking about the army here, we're talking about engineers, scientists, bureaucrats, alliance partners, industry. We can see who's talking about it in a particular way. And you get a different interpretation about how change is working across the military from its partners that actually make the technologies that end up in the hands of soldiers, all the way through the different layers and levels of the organization, of the various organizations that are involved in bringing that piece of kit onto the battlefield. And it's an assumption, it seems to me, that when we talk about military innovation, that these pieces of kit just sort of appear as if there's no debate, you know, that there might not be any winners and losers in the process of this kit appearing. And, you know, which industrial partner is going to win any contract? As if they haven't got a stake in the process, as if they haven't got a stake in shaping the way the process unfolds in order to guarantee that their kit gets selected. So you can, once I start spinning the story the other way around, this notion that there's this obvious progression from lower forms of technology to more sophisticated forms of technology starts to, you know, you need to start treating that narrative with some caution. Because there is a lot of small p politics, if you like, that are working in the back channels that shape particular ways of working. Just from the artifact technology as an artifact, all the way through to the process of making the technology or making the technology work in a particular circumstance, or the know-how associated with getting the technology to work in a particular way. All of those, there's a lot of different moving parts. I was very lucky one time to be flown onto the US Navy's nuclear-powered aircraft carrier, and that is a complex piece of kit. And orchestrating all of those pieces, those different things, you know, it's really sophisticated. Tracing how innovation works in that environment, given the complexity of that platform, you know, would require, if I ended up writing a book of, I don't know, 100,000 words, you know, to do what I did with small arms for systems of systems like an aircraft carrier like that, I think could be, you know, a sizable volume if you took my approach. But I think there's lots to commend my approach.
One of the biggest issues with nuclear-powered aircraft carriers compared to rifles is that you can't strip and assemble an aircraft carrier in 60 seconds. And if you could, well, your drill sergeant would be pretty proud of you at the time. So just listening to the way you've described the narratives and, you know, what we traditionally think, in fact, what is taught in history classes in schools probably around the world, this evolution of military technology, it's still taken quite a while for small arms to, I suppose, develop and mature. There's other advances in science that have gone along hand in hand with it, although don't tell the infantry that science is involved in small arms. But why do you think it's taken so long to, or had did it take long Did people have a focus on the small arm, or were they trying to increase that distance between themselves and those they sought to do harm?
So it's a legitimate question to say that the nature of winning battles is different, in that actually we need to be thinking about your interests, interest in artillery, elsewhere. You know, distance is clearly a Western preference for fighting wars. Of course, it all starts to fall down when you fight insurgencies, at which point actually small arms are really rather important for helping just manage the population, police the population, control the population. And just to pick up the point, you know, is there science involved in small arms? Absolutely there is. And the science associated with lethality is, of course, contested. People spend a lot of time speaking in terms of kinetic effects. Infantry officers, you know, military types will talk about kinetic effects. But that's rooted in a scientific investigation during the Second World War into how to produce more lethal effects. And, of course, what you find is that British scientists and American scientists during the Second World War had a completely different perspective of what produced lethality. British scientists would look at lethality in terms of momentum effects. Americans were keen to retain kinetic energy as a mode of describing lethality. And for all sorts of structural reasons associated with American investment in science and the science associated with lethality, and the Brits withdrawing from doing primary research in lethality, you start to realize why Americans might be able to dominate debates about how we would define lethality. And it becomes a structural question about lethality being understood in terms of kinetic effects rather than momentum effects. But, you know, those narratives, if the investment had been in a different place, you know, you could see those narratives working out in a different way. And there's something about, I suppose, and that's the key to my book, there's something about the relationship between these modes of analysis and how power might work within the organization. You know, in crude terms, lethality debates were framed by Americans' willingness to put money into investigating lethality and Brits being unwilling to do that. And no wonder you get to various NATO standardization debates and the rest of it. And the criteria for defining lethality and ammunition choice are dictated along American lines, ruling out British variants like the 485 in the 1970s or caseless ammunition that the Germans were working on in the 1970s, or any other odd variety or variant that, you know, the Americans had developed 556. They wanted everyone to use 556. Interestingly, though, there were ways of subverting that narrative came about as a result of industry, Fabrique Nationale, working in having a particularly fascinating strategy for unpicking the American and American approach, which ultimately was connected to their desire to sell FN Mini-Me to the Americans. So they effectively designed ammunition that would work particularly well in their FN Mini-Me. And because the Americans wanted to buy FN Mini-Me, you know, they realized that they should adopt the Belgian version of 556 rather than the... And, of course, it kept Europeans happy and it kept the Americans happy, just about. Of course, that also led to the iteration of the M16 to the A2 version, because they had to the Americans were very annoyed about having to rebarrel their weapons to stop fouling and all that shit. But your first question was about maturing incrementally, if I remember correctly, which is where I was trying to get to. And of course, I allowed myself to rabbit on. I think what I've alluded to just in that last 5 minutes or so is that actually one of the reasons why technologies don't change is because they are the physical representation of a series of bargains that go on within the military organisation. Now, you know, in Britain, And I think to a lesser extent in the US, you tell me in Australia, but I imagine it's pretty much the same there. The introduction of every small arm into army service has been associated with some kind of controversy. From 1870, the Martini Henry being replaced, it, of course, it failed in the Sudan. The Lee Metford came along. You go through to the SMLE. The SMLE, it was a 303 round. It didn't, you know, there were lots of people in Britain who didn't think it worked. 303 rounds worked particularly well in Afghanistan. And so the dum-dum controversy emerged. You move forward, you have the EM2, the experimental model number two, and the SLR. A huge amount of controversy associated with that. And of course, you have over the last, well, the Enfield weapon system, which was the precursor to the SA-80, came out, was first mooted in the early 70s. And it took until, what, 2000, 2001, before the British Army had a properly working SA-80A2. So that was only, what, I don't know, 30-odd years of farting about trying to get a piece of kit into soldiers' hands that might actually do the job that they needed to do. You've got to remember that each one of these technologies has a huge amount of bargaining going on into it. You know, I realise that when users present engineers with a set of a user requirement, it's one set of it's one document, but that document is the result of a whole series of bargains across regiments, across units, who amongst people who have potentially, at least, completely conflicting different interpretations of the tactical engagement. And I mean, this is really rather obvious in places like the second. You can see this really clearly in the Second World War. The Brits, the Brits were definitely through the Directorate of Infantry, through the Battle School movement. Were keen to try and pursue a more, I'm trying to think of the right word now, my brain has just seized up. They were trying to think of, they were absolutely interested in adopting more appropriate fire and movement tactics. You know, this was the kinds of things that, you know, you would have learned maybe on the First World War that were difficult to implement in a non-professional army. And of course, that perspective was not something that senior leaders in the British Army were keen to engage with when they had started to perfect during the North Africa campaign and into Sicily. And I'm thinking in particular Montgomery. They were starting to perfect the operational techniques that would allow them to do precisely what you said earlier, which was to combine arms in a particular way in sequencing them, and then start to win the engagement at an operational level. There is, you know, why sacrifice your men on the altar of tactical efficiency when actually you can win the engagement at a distance, coordinating blows, bringing different units and services and combined arms together in order to achieve the same result, especially if it keeps losses down and, you know, you're winning. So there was one instance of a tactical engagement, of a tactical versus an operational engagement that was at odds. But, you know, if you just look at things in terms of marksmanship and firepower, the US had a particular, they were particularly wedded to marksmanship. Just as the Brits were experimenting, certain parts of the Brits were communities within the British military were experimenting with fire and movement and the technologies that might enable tactical flexibility. That's not to say that the Americans themselves weren't engaged in that, but, you know, frontline commanders were wedded to the M1 Garand, they were wedded to marksmanship type techniques, and, you know, effectively there was a congruence between British and American operational technique, you know, broadly conceived, that kept innovations locked on, in a particular way on the battlefield. But, you know, innovative technologies, you'd expect to be machine guns and all the rest of it, things that require independent choice. You'd expect an independent thinking, leadership, if you like. you'd expect to come from societies that valued democracy and the surprising thing is, of course, is that the places that adopted the what is commonly discussed as the ideal small arm, the assault rifle, the countries that adopted those first were Nazi Germany and the Soviet Union. And, you know, Brits and Americans wedded to professional armed forces looked at marksmanship as more important than ultimately than the firepower, the flexibility that came out of assault rifles. But, you know, there were debates between the Americans and Brits about how to best prosecute the tactical engagement. And I suppose that's the first step. You know, users themselves struggle sometimes to come to a agreed position. And one that is agreed may not just be an agreement. It may be a diktat. You know, someone's actually, you know, people roll into a job, they roll out of a job over 2 years. In those 2 years, they dictate what the policy will be. Another person comes in, you know, things start to change. Even once you've handed over the user requirement, assuming that that is settled and there are no arguments or debates within the user community, let's make that assumption, you still have to go to engineers. And of course, engineers have different views about what the technical solution might look like for the user community. And of course, you can put it through trials and all the rest of it. But once you get from the engineer, say you've got a technical problem, I mean, this, in my, what I fix on is lethality. You have two technical solutions in the 1940s and late 1940s and 50s. Brits have a view, the Americans have a view. How do you resolve which one's best? They go and talk to scientists. But the problem is, of course, scientists have different views about what lethality might mean. Hence my point about kinetic, you know, my observation earlier about kinetic effects and momentum effects. So if scientists can't even tell you what the best is, then how the hell do you tell what the best is, right? We're trying to get the best bit of kit into the soldiers' hands. Users aren't sure. They've given us a user requirement. It looks like it's settled. We'll give it to the engineers. We've got engineers trying to protect their particular pet theories or their approaches. You know, after the Second World War, the Americans and the Brits were forced into a situation, a sort of pre-NATO relationship. This is where it starts to become about defence industrial policy. Whoever won those standardisation debates after the Second World War, ultimately, they would have the opportunity to... this reached deep into defence industrial policy, because if you define the standard, then potentially you could dictate the terms in which others would build bits of kit, and you might find that you could protect your defence industrial base more effectively by dictating the standards. You get to scientists, same problem. You go from scientists, though. The interesting thing about the scientists' challenges and lethality was ultimately something that wasn't defined by scientists themselves. It had to be a bureaucratic response. Bureaucrats had to make up their mind because decisions had to be made. Scientists might not agree, but you need to crack on and get a decision made about what kit you're going to put in the hands of the soldier. You may disagree with it, but you need to crack on. And then it comes down to structural power, you know, as I was alluding to earlier. I suppose ultimately, my penultimate chapter, my final chapter is about saying, even when you start to run these things through alliance partners, once you've got past that and everyone's had their say as to what might work for them as an alliance partner, as an individual nation, you've still got to engage with industry. And industry's got to come out and design something and build something that that the user might want. And you know, my real conclusion in this respect is to suggest that actually over the last 20 or so years, the engineering community within government has become, certainly in the UK, maybe in the US, I don't know how it is in Australia, but certainly become hollowed out. So you don't have enough experts within government themselves to evaluate, to scrutinize and evaluate designs. And so you get a user community that actually is given the opportunity to buy what it wants. Certainly the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, through urgent operational requirements and various other things, you can buy what you want, but there's no evaluation there's insufficient oversight to make sure that it is actually fit for purpose, or that it might work in the longer term, or that it fits within the nation's priorities overall. And the question I have is, you know, given that there's a sort of a hollowing out of engineering expertise, has industry exploited this? And my view is that actually, absolutely, it has. Industry has worked very hard to shape the choices of the user community in such a way as to turn the user community into a consumer. So soldiers aren't picking what they think. You know, this effectiveness debate that you might have about kit is only one half of it. You know, actually, it's effectiveness and fashion. You know, and you have military fashions. And the most obvious would be digital patterns in camouflage. But the same applies to small arms. And there are a number of people who have widgets and, you know, Picatinny rails with all sorts of sights and stocks and grips and, you know, God knows what. You know, and they start to influence what people think is the most appropriate. And of course, that's most easily done through the special forces community, who have independent budgets, who can go around the world and buy the bits of kit that they want for the specific operations that they want. And you know, you don't have to. If you're Green Army, it doesn't take much to. If you see one of these guys, you look at the Gucci gear that these guys have, and you realise that if you want some Gucci gear, you have to either be SF or the SF community, or work in an elite regiment, or you have to try and put pressure on the procurement guys to get the kind of gear that everyone else has. It creates this status anxiety. And status anxiety, I think, can be easily exploited by industry. You can sell gear in ways that shape demand, and shape demand in a way that isn't always most appropriate in terms of what makes sense strategically, what makes sense systematically or organisationally, in terms of logistics, training, supply chain, all this kind of stuff, right?
Now, Matthew, I would love to sit here and talk all day about my personal views on the SA-80A2, maybe posit some of the theories put forward to me about why I'm using the wrong rifle when I go hunting, or posit some of the theories that have been put to me on why the militaries use the wrong sort of weapons these days as compared to the SLR from Vietnam. However, we do have one more question to ask, and it's a question that all my guests get, and it's not related to small arms. It's related to our mission. It's related to Big Carl's mission, and it's about defining and debating war. Each guest gets to finish the sentence, "War is." So I ask you, our smallest of armed guests so far, can you finish the sentence, "War is"?
Yeah, I've been thinking about this question. It's not an easy question to ask to answer. And I like to write short sentences, even though I was prattling on there for a good, I don't know how long it was, half an hour. I thought about this, and I've got sort of, there are obviously sophisticated answers, which involve going to read lots of books. And then there was a sort of flippant or semi-flippant, but, you know, alluding to the challenges, and I think I kept coming back to war is complex, and don't do it too often. That is what it seems to me that it's an instrument of power, and it's not going anywhere it got not going away anytime soon. And it makes some sense to spend some time thinking about it carefully. Because if it starts, we have to be very, very careful about knowing what we're getting into. I can wax philosophical here, and I think that was half the challenge, right? You've given me a philosophical question that I need to stop myself from becoming too philosophical over. At the end of the goddamn interview, stop talking.
That's the trick. That's the trick. A lot of guests get trapped in that. We don't ask them to finish the paragraph or the book. We just ask them to finish a sentence. It's a complex task to complete, but war is complex, and don't do it too often is quite a good response. I think our listeners will get a bit of a kick out of that. Now, thank you very much for coming on the show. It's been very interesting listening to the details and changing, I know, my personal perspective on how we've had developments in the small arms area across the global military world. So, Matthew, thank you very much for coming on the show, and I hope the book goes well. Listeners, you can follow Matthew on War Matters in the Twitter sphere if you are a Twitter person. If you are not a Twitter person, get on Twitter and then follow him anyway. Follow us, then follow him. Matthew, thank you very much.
Thanks, mate.
Listeners, now we have another review coming up next week. I'm going to keep that format happening so that I can keep you both updated and give you a little bit more content this year, because I know how fast and voracious you are at consuming information. But until next time, listeners, grab a book and crack on.
Join the conversation with us on Twitter at Dead Prussian Pod, on Facebook at The Dead Prussian Page, or on our website www.thedeadprussian.com. All show notes for this episode, as well as copyright information, can be found on the website. The Dead Prussian Podcast is written, produced and hosted by Mick Cook. It is co-produced by Amanda Levito. The music used throughout is Caught in the Beat by Broke for Free and is used under a Creative Commons Attribution License. All opinions expressed by individuals on the podcast are those of the individual and not necessarily representative of any other organisation.
Welcome to another round of Drawing Board or Miro Board. Today, we talk brainstorms with UX designer Brian. Let's go. First question. You thought you'd see everyone's idea in the team brainstorm, but you've got a grand total of one. Drawing board or Miro board?
Drawing board, right? Because in Miro, the team can add ideas now or later. And with privacy mode, we can keep them anonymous until they're good to share.
Correct. Next, you need the best way to explain your idea, but all you have is a few sticky notes. Drawing board or Miro board?
Drawing board, because, you know, in Miro, I could record videos, add text, images, links, and digital sticky notes, of course, present my thoughts the way I want.
Right again. Now, you're looking for a past idea you thought was just genius. Only you could find... Oh, there it is. Drawing board or...
Miro. All our finished and unfinished work lives in one place.
And he's won.
Join over 60 million people getting ideas noticed in Miro brainstorms. Get your first three boards for free at Miro.com. That's Miro.com.
Whether you're looking to build a website for your business, your hobby, your podcast, or just for fun, Pear Networks is your go-to web hosting partner. Not only do we have the lowest domain price in the industry, starting at just $11, we've got hundreds of stunning website templates to help you stand out from the crowd. You're not a techie? Not a problem. With our easy DIY site builders, you can launch your impressive website without any technical know-how. And when it comes to security and updates, don't worry, we've got you covered. Our 24/7 US-based customer support is the best in the industry. Check out pear.com today to learn more. PAIR.com.